So I redid my kitchen, about 10 years ago. I didn't redo my kitchen. I had to make a kitchen. I hadn't had no kitchen. So we redid my kitchen. It had, at the time, you know, it was very like spitzy with an island, just like that in the magazines. But whenever you used the sink on the island, whatever was on the island got soaking wet. I have no idea why. Any water that dripped just like went over the whole counter. And I am the master of living with problems. I those types of things aren't going to bother me. I just don't put anything on the island. So for the last 8 years, I think since we did that kitchen, I wouldn't put anything on the island, and if I did, it was almost begetting yish. I didn't care about it. Someone else put their things on it, that's their problem. I left my things off the island. And my wife, she's more the problem solver in the house. So the other day, now what are you going to do? It's just happened. It's just, we're just living with it. I'm going to make a point at the end of this. And she saw next door to us, someone's putting in a kitchen. So she walked into the guy, and she said, when you take a break, could you come next door to my house? I need to show you something in my kitchen. So he showed the guy the problem, and he said, the counter in this kitchen is, I guess this is not such rocket science for you, right? Regina probably figured this out already. It sloped the wrong way. And that's why any water that gets on from the sink, gets onto the counter, just drips and sloping away from the sink, and everything gets wet. You just have to lift it in the other direction, and all the water will go back to the sink. I just remember getting to figure that out at the beginning. I didn't know that. I used to lift an island. It's put in. It was put in 8 years ago. So, but this guy figured out, he took a piece of wood, very, very slight, and chiseled. It was the thinnest piece of wood. It looked like a very thin piece of toast that's pressed down. But it had no give, and he figured out a way how to wedge it in. And would you believe that the problem I lived with for 8 years, I tested this out last night in preparation for the schmooze. And if you pour water on my counter on the island, you're all welcome to come. Knock on my door. If I'm not home, just tell my wife you were invited. You take a cup of water, pour it on my island. And we will watch all of the water drip slowly from one end of the island, eventually go down into the sink. And if you walk into my island before or after, it looks flat. Which is a very amazing concept, which I'd like to bring to your attention. The word hashpa comes from the word shafua, which is slope. The biggest mashpiyim do not have to do anything. They just exist. They're a flat island, and it looks flat, but there's an incline. And that little incline, okay, you have a big incline, you'd be a bigger mashpia, but that this little incline already has a huge, could have a huge impact. If it's in the wrong direction, it could be the wrong direction. Hashpa would be a huge impact. We're changing the clocks for Tzoy Shabbos. And I said this over, I don't know if it was the high school or the Beis Menesh, I don't remember. But one of the Gedolim, the Sforim I see, asked the Kasha, you think about it, you speak to somebody in St. Louis, it's an hour earlier, I think Houston, Texas is 2 hours earlier. No? Is any place 2 hours earlier? You guys don't know anything. Arizona's 2 hours earlier? Tucson is 2 hours earlier. California is 3 hours. 3 hours. Israel is 7 hours. There are places that are 9 hours. There are places that are 12 hours. Why did the Rosh Hashanah make it that we're living with different time zones? To me, it would make sense if I was creating the world. I would have done a little differently. I would have done it that everyone gets up in the morning at the same time. We watch the same news that happened during the day. Daylight's from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And nighttime, it gets dark. Why are there all these different time zones? And they write, this is very powerful, I want you to hear it. It's very, very powerful. It's because that the world without Torah would collapse, would implode. It would literally collapse. Torah keeps the world afloat. Without Torah, the world, as you know, you see the globe, we're suspended in midair. It would just fall. So there could be no world without Torah. That's why there's different time zones. Because somehow, over the 24 hours, there are people learning. It's an amazing, amazing phenomenon. Rabbi Harris was here. He left over some, gave us some amazing marmakomos on this sugya. I want to say a couple of them over to you. Aveli Eliapian makes the following observation. Everyone knows the story of Sodom. They were going to wipe out Sodom unless there was some tzaddikim, but there were no tzaddikim. So Sodom got wiped out. We know how evil they were in Sodom. They killed Yevam the Chesed. They were evil. It was anti-culture. These were a city of thugs. Nowadays, there would be thugs. I picture it would be now Sodom nowadays, where I would see it. You walk into Sodom. You're going to have people wearing bare-chested with a vest, tattoos all over the place, with a bandana around their forehead, on a motorcycle, on the way to their motorcycle. That was Sodom. Evil. Now, let's say there would have been the tzaddikim that they were looking for. They didn't find the tzaddikim. Let's say there would have been tzaddikim in Sodom. So Sodom would not have gotten wiped out. And then what? Everyone in Sodom would be walking around saying, you see, Sodom is good. They'd be walking around thinking that they're regular people. No problem. We're existing. Yet, what's the truth? The real truth is the only reason why Sodom would be existing was because of these tzaddikim. But no one realizes. They'd be walking around thinking that they're it. There are wars that take place. Everyone comes back. The Chayalim come back. All the soldiers, everyone starts picking a parade that these soldiers helped win the war. What does that do with the soldiers winning the war? The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted them to win the war. I'll tell you an amazing maisa that happened in the United States of America during, I think, Bush 1 campaign, when Iraq went in and invaded Kuwait. So the American armed forces put their foot down We are not going to allow a foreign country to invade another foreign country. Even though I have no shackles to America, I have no idea where Kuwait is. I don't think anyone in the United States cared about Kuwait. I don't think anyone ever heard of Kuwait before this. Now, Iraq went into Kuwait, and the United States gave them like 48 hours to get out. This was major news. This is better than theater. This is better than any basketball game. So Bush told Hussein to get out of Kuwait, or we're going to kick you out. And Saddam Hussein said that you just try to do anything to us, and the United States will suffer like they've never suffered before. This is total fantasy. And he said, this will be the mother, he's announcing on national Iraq television that this is going to be the mother of all wars, and the holy Iraq is going to come out and become the rulers of the world. And Bush was on national television saying that they now have 20 hours. Now they have 12 hours. And it was a countdown. And Hussein, and they had him in hidden spots, kept saying that, let them try kicking us out of Kuwait. And then the hour came, 0 hour came, and the United States Air Force, and followed up by Marines, went in to Kuwait. They annihilated the entire Iraqi Air Force within the first 70 minutes, pulverized every Iraqi soldier. They dropped down leaflets to tell all the Kuwaitis to get out of there because they're going to annihilate anything in sight. And I don't know about, it was like 100 hours of war. After 100 hours, the United States said mission accomplished. Iraq was dead. There was no mother of all wars. They didn't shoot a bullet. Iraq didn't have a bullet to shoot. Rav Shmuel Birnbaum, Zatzal, the great Rosh Yeshiva, Mir Rosh Yeshiva in New York, amazing Gadol B'Torah. I had the good fortune, and when I was in the old, first came to Miami, I was sitting in the, I'm going to get to what he said, but I have to know who Rav Shmuel was. We really should get a picture of Shmuel Birnbaum. I was sitting in the dining room in the old building, which none of you saw, and there was room for like four people in the, there was like a Rebbe room, a coffee room. I was sitting there by myself, racing to eat breakfast, going to class, and Rav Shmuel Birnbaum walked in. I stood up, like to sit down. And I was teaching eighth grade. The school was seventh grade through 12th grade, I was teaching eighth grade. He wanted to know, what are you learning? I said, you know, I was a little bit embarrassed, we're doing, you know, Gemara Rashi, and Rav Shmuel Birnbaum, you know, saying, Eila Gitarra. So what are you learning? He wanted to know. I forgot what learning. I think I should fit, or I forgot. I was the Zikin. He was so excited. He wanted to know what we were learning. He would learn, they say, by chasanas. If a six-year-old was there, he used to come, if he was there and no one else was there, he would learn with a six-year-old. He didn't care. Whoever he could talk to, he would talk and learning. So Shmuel Birnbaum was Kula Torah. So in recognition of the United States Armed Forces that went in to Kuwait, I don't know if it was by this war or the second Iraqi war, he delayed the Pesach vacation and they extended the winter's man by one day. That's Shmuel Birnbaum. the Mir Yeshiva New York. Of course, the United States Armed Forces were very successful, and they're probably looking at all their tanks and all their Air Force, thinking that, wow, they're so sophisticated, smart bombs, and who knows what. And it's very likely, I'm not to say, but it's very likely the reason why they were successful is because this building on Avenue R in Ocean Parkway had a reshiva who, as a appreciation for the American Armed Forces, allowed the United States to be successful in that Iraqi excursion. I want you to hear what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was the miyasid of the whole Musar movement, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said in his old age, Kol Yemei Chayei, all of my years, Sha'afti Lios Kemo Agra. He tried and he aspired to be like the Vilna Gaon. I didn't become the Vilna Gaon, but that's why I became Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He said this in his old age. The Chafetz Chaim said, listen to this, Napoleon. We know the great Napoleon, the great general. Napoleon said that a chayel, a soldier, who does not have the aspiration, the desire to become a general, Af chayel poshet enenu. He's not even a simple soldier. A soldier should have the aspiration to become the general. The Chavetz Chaim said that a ben yeshiva, we are b'nei yeshiva. We're in yeshiva, so if we're in yeshiva, we're b'nei yeshiva. A ben yeshiva has to have the she'ifa, has to have the aspiration to be a general, to be a gadol b'Torah. And he said, just like Napoleon, if you don't have, I apologize for being so strong, to say this strongly, I want you to hear it. Could you elbow him on the left rib? Thank you. I want you to hear this. A ben yeshiva who doesn't have the desire to be a gadol b'Torah, he's not even a ben yeshiva. What does that mean? Gentlemen, we are B'nai Yeshiva. That's what we are. We always write every letter. The B'nai Yeshiva will be whatever. But the Chafetz Chaim said, you're not a Ben Yeshiva if you don't have the desire to be a Gadol B'Torah. I don't think the Chafetz Chaim didn't have to put names to it. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was able to say, be like the Gra. He didn't say you have to put a name to it. But if we want to be a real Ben Yeshiva, we have to have the aspiration to be a gadol b'Torah, each one of us. We have to take it in our hearts. Every one of you, you write all their goals in life. This is supposed to be our main goal in life, to be a gadol b'Torah. Everyone, this is, walk out of this room today, everyone has to take it upon themselves. That is the objective of every ben yeshiva, every soldier. When Napoleon said every soldier, he means if you're enlisted, you're a soldier. If you're here, you're a soldier. You're a ben yeshiva. If you're here, you're in. Otherwise, what are you doing here? So you're in the building, but if a person doesn't have the desire to be a gadol b'Torah, then you just exist. There are cockroaches in the building too. They're here. We don't call them the B'nai Yeshiva. So a person could exist, be like a cockroach. They're just in the building. This each person, no one can do this for you. Each person has to have that aspiration, that objective in their minds, I am going to be a Gadol B'Torah. And that, just that aspiration is enough. That Napoleon said it. What more, who more do we have to hear it from? Napoleon said it. Rabbi Yisroel Salanter said it. Chafetz Chaim said it. It's probably true. And the more we mean it, the more it will come to fruition to the extent that we like. That is our objective. We want to be a Gadol B'Torah. I see over here, it's amazing, it says that Chazal Darshan, Ein Mayim El Torah, Torah is compared to water. So the Mefarshim asked, why is Torah compared to water? That's not exciting. If you want to compare Torah to a drink, I pick a fine wine. I don't really like fine wines, but the people that do, a fine wine, compare it to some kind of fruit drink, some exotic kiwi, strawberry, what do you call those things? Yeah, that. If you're comparing Torah to a drink, find a drink that's exotic and compare it to that. Listen to the Teretz. The Chafetz Chaim answered this question. He says as follows, there's a halacha in Mishnah Berurah brought down, Siman Reish Dalet, someone who drinks water, but not because they're thirsty, he does not have to make a bracha. If you're drinking water, whatever, you want to swallow medication, you don't make a bracha on it because you're not water, because you're not getting a hanah. You're not doing it for thirst, and you're just doing it to swallow the water. You do not make a bracha on such on drinking that water. He says the same thing is true with Torah. That to learn Torah, we have to develop a thirst for Torah. That's not so easy. In the younger years, not so easy. We're still trying to learn how to read the Gemara, and sometimes it could be hard. But we stick with it, we develop a thirst. A person learns with a thirst. That's the Torah. That's why it's compared to Mayim. Mayim only break a bracha on, you learn it with a thirst. I want to conclude. There was one more. I want to conclude with one maisa that Rabbi Harris said over. I was blown away by this maisa, and I had to go through it a few times to make sure I got it right. Let's see if I find it. Here it is. Everybody heard of the Mesillas Yesharim, the great Musa Sefer written by the Ramchal. Fellas, listen to the story. It's mind-boggling. In the year Tav Ches, okay, someone tell me what year. I'm so bad at this. But now it's Tav Resh Ayin Tes. That's 5,779. And Tav Ches is 5,408. Yeah, I'm sorry. Tavshin Ayin Tes is 5779, and this is 5408. So 300 and 75 years ago. So what year is that? 375. Come on, you guys are better at math. You have Miss Dagener. Can you make me do it? What year? 1650. Thank you. In the year 1650. In the year 1650, this story took place. In the year 1650, there was terrible gzeiros in Klal Yisrael. Yidden were being tortured. Community after community, they were being tortured, shechted. They tortured them alive. And there was a great mekubal, Rab Shimshon Ashtipoli. So this mekubal somehow, during this gzera, he was able to speak to the Malach HaMavis and said, what are you doing this to us for? What can we do to get these terrible pogroms to stop? Gentlemen, in case anyone thinks this story is not relevant to us, you take a look at the swastikas on the matzevas in France and what's going on around the world. You should need to hear the story. Regretfully, history shows this is relevant to us. You must hear the story. So this Rabbi Shimon Ashkenazi spoke to the Malach HaMavis. He was a mekubal. But Kabbalim could speak to anyone they want. So the Malach HaMavis said like this: If you are able to nullify these three things, get rid of them, I'll stop. What are the three things? Get rid of Shabbos, get rid of Bris Milah, and Torah and Limud Torah. You get rid of those three, all the gzeiros will stop. So this mekubal told the Malach HaMavis, shecht whoever you want, not one os of Torah should be eradicated, should be nullified. And that's how it ended, so we thought. They said over this maisa to Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, and he said, that's not the end of the maisa. This Mekubal, Reb Shimshon Ashtipoli, and he went and he did a Shelas Chalom. I have no idea how to do a Shelas Chalom. So you get to ask a Shaila in a Chalom that they should tell him in a Shemayim what he should do. This terrible, terrible, Jews were getting killed by the hundreds and hundreds on a daily basis, from community to community. So this is the tshuva he got from Shemayim. If you'll be able to get two gedolei hadar who'll be ready to give up their lives and give up their neshamas to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this will stop the entire pogrom. Why? Because a misa of a tzaddik is mechaper. The death of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, is some kind of kapara for Klal Yisrael, just like Yom Kippur cleanses all of our sins. So too, the death of a tzaddik, it cleanses the sins of Klal Yisrael. And if you get two, like the Shnei Bnei Aaron, if you get two gedolim to give up their lives prematurely, this will stop the gzeiros. So Rav Shimshon Ashtipoli, he knew that he was a gadol b'Torah, old guy aside, and he knew who he was. He said, okay, I will be the first. I need to find the second one. So he went to the Shach, not to be confused with Rav Shach, who passed away 10 years ago. The Shach in the Shulchan Aruch, on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, Sifsei Kohen, Shapsi Cohen, I think that was his name, the Shach, So he was a great gadol in Achron, and they went to him and he asked him if he would be the second one. He says, I have to think about it. Come back in 2 days. In 2 days, I'll have an answer for you. He came back in 2 days, and he says, I'll do it. One condition, though. I need 3 months to finish up something I'm doing. Give me 3 months. So Reb Shimshon said, there are Jews being murdered by the day. What? If you're ready to say, if you can say no, fine, say no. But if you're ready to say yes, what is so important that you have to do that people get killed every day? So he answered, I'm finishing my Pirish now on Shulchan Aruch. Indeed, Pirish Shach on the Shulchan Aruch was being finished, completed. And the 2 days he needed was to figure out how long he needed to finish. So he needed 3 more months. You come in 3 months. And Kach Hava, 3 months went by. The Shach's Pirish on the Shulchan Aruch was completed and put into the Shulchan Aruch as one of the Nosei Kelim to read the Shulchan Aruch with. And the Gzeris Tach V'Tat, during the years of Tav Ches and Tav Tes, 48 and 49. All the Gzeris stopped the day that the Shach was Nifter. So Rav Issa Zalman asked the question, what was Pshat? You know how many hundreds and hundreds of people died during those 3 months? For what purpose? Rabosai, this is pretty frightening, but it shows the power that we have. The learning that we do to clarify the sugyas of the Gemara, of Torah Shebaal Peh, is worth everything. Even the Gzeris Tach V'Tat, 3 months of it, the Shach felt was worth it. To bring this, I don't think he was doing it for his own edification, for his own, name. It was for the Chedushi Torah. Torah is what makes the world stay afloat. Who better to do it? Rebbe say, who else is there? There aren't too many Bnei Yeshiva. And if we are going to be a Ben Yeshiva, let's do it the way it's supposed to be. Let's have it with the aspiration that we're going to be Gedolim. We're learning that we're going to become Gedolei Torah. Each one of us can become Gedolei Torah. There is no question. Someone who learns Torah become a master in Torah. I had the following observation. I just want to say it in a way that's not going to come out disrespectful. But if you look at the elementary schools, so the first grade teacher teaches, English, math, social studies, science, second grade teacher, third grade teacher, fourth grade teacher, fifth grade teacher. By sixth grade, it is rare, it does exist, but it's more rare to find a teacher that's a master to teach the math, the science, the English, the history, social studies. Seventh grade, Kemat doesn't exist. It's all departmentalized. This person's specialist in math, this person's specialist in science. Eighth grade in high school, non-existent. There are teachers who could teach more than one subject, but it's unusual. I think you never find it, but it's very unusual to have someone who could be a master in all four disciplines, math, science, or studies, English, at those high levels. And professors in college, certainly not. But you think about it, in Kodesh, even though there are probably are some places that have departmentalized, but it's probably more for scheduling purposes, that there are Rabbonim that are masters in Halacha and in Gemara, Ian and Bekiyas and Navi and Jewish history and Megillah and whatever, enrichment type things. There are people who are masters in all the disciplines. Think about it for a second, it's pashut. Because there's a certain extra siyata d'shmaya that you learn in yeshiva, you could become a gadol b'torah. A gadol b'torah means the entire Torah, all the disciplines. All of the disciplines. There's not a, you know, have to hire a halacha specialist and a gemara specialist. You can become specialists in everything. That's just to show you how great a gadol we could all become. I was in high school. I was just exactly like you. As a matter of fact, probably most of you were ahead of me where I was when I was in high school. I was probably from the more less likely people to be standing here speaking than many other boys in my class. Many other boys. I just ended up learning much longer than they did. They learned for a year or two, and they ended up going to college, and they got married earlier, and they ended up in business and professions. They're wonderful fellows, all wonderful. But when we were in high school, they were smarter than I was. They were probably better students than I was. You can't find out what's the problem. I'll tell you some of my antics from my youth. But if you learn yeshiva and you make it, take upon yourself, just you want to be able to know Torah, that you want to be a gadol b'Torah is not so complicated. That does not necessarily have to affect what you do in your life. Just that you can be a gadol b'Torah, you're going to master Torah. We're not even telling you that anything to do with what your careers will be. But if you're sitting in yeshiva, you're here anyway. It's not like you have this decision to stay or not to stay. You're being yeshiva, you tell yourself, I am going to become a gadol b'Torah. That little slope, that little perspective makes all the difference which direction the water is going. Have a great day.